This is the prayer list for this week. Prayers for happy rebirth. All those killed by natural and man-made disasters. For all those killed by others or by their own hands. Jordan Johnson, Yutha Landis, Edward Story, Carolyn White, Shanti the Mouse, Shine the Chipmunk. Job search. With Ann Barona, Travis Boone, Brian and Brandy, Joe Griffiths, Jim Kay, Bruce Miller, Lindsay Piatti, Sarai, Pooja Shah, Greg Weaver, Joe Whitley. Prayers for health and well-being. Kaji Lama Sump Rinpoche, Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, Venerable Galton, Venerable Chuki Lamo, all those harmed by natural and man-made disasters, Jorge Aurelio, Jim Barnes, Carl Barnett, Luce and Narcissus Barona, Narcissus Barona Sr., Susie Baum, Dale Bullis, Yuki Boros, Ted Domi, Tashi Droma, Mildred Grush, Trace House Thompson, Christina Harrison, Frank Holt, Kenny Jackson Buddy, Dallin Sue Johnson, family of Jordan Johnson, Barry Judge, Helen Kastanoff, Jonathan Kramer, Shondi Kurt Latimer, family of Yutha Landis, Jim Lilligan family, Kim Lillig, Mary Lojek, Ina Lovelace, R.M., Georgia McDonald and family, Leonard Macklis, Wilbert Martin, Florence Fisher McClure, Elvia Mahian family, Bruce Miller, David Muller, Audrey Murphy, Marie and Kevin Murphy, Evan Myrtle and family, Jessica Nunley, Marie Oliver, Jay Pondia, Dan Pascal, Lindsay Piatti, Renee Reyna, Ann Rivers, James Rowan and Teresa Creighton, Ralph Romley, Ariana Scott, Joanne Cease, Ronnie Schumann and family, Andre Smith, Emily Smith, Nancy Sorbet, Lovson Topton, Dion Washington, family of Carolyn White, Shea Wokowicki, Margaret Young, Alberto Isunza, Brittany the Maltese, Dorjan Cotto the Pigs, Padme Tara and Padme Solomon the Cats, Tom the Cat, Utpala Lily the Cat. And in case somehow we don't have time to do the sponsor dedications this afternoon, these are the sponsors and their dedications. Susie Boehm, in gratitude for the kindness of all our Dharma teachers. Neil Oldham, to the Sangha and their spread of the Dharma, with special thanks to Venerable Amy for her work on Buddhism in a nutshell. Sandy Carlson, any positive potential created by the sponsorship is dedicated to his long, healthy, happy lives of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Ken Rinpoche, Jetsun Losan Delek, Lama Zompa Rinpoche, Geshe Gelug, Geshe Sangpo, Venerable Amy, and all our precious Sangha. May Kadampa Center's community continue to be a benefit to each other and countless sentient beings for eons and eons. Donna Cease, by hearing these precious teachings, may we create the cause to see emptiness directly and liberate ourselves from samsara. Having freed ourselves, may we become Buddhas and return to lead all sentient beings to the bliss of liberation. Diane Mayer, dedicated to Joan Loeb Miller, mentor and guide. John Castello, may our precious teacher stay with us all the way to enlightenment.
Good morning. I'm Donna Cease. I'm co-spiritual programs coordinator for the Kadampa Center. And I want to thank you all for coming to spend your Saturday hearing these precious teachings. How wonderful. It's a lot nicer than the beach, I think. So Venerable, just a little bit about Venerable Amy. She encountered the Dharma at a teaching at Kopan Monastery in Kathmandu about 30 years ago. She began teaching in 1992, and she was ordained in 2000. She's a very well-regarded teacher. She was previously director of the Milarepa Center in Vermont. She teaches at FPMT centers all around the country. She has led pilgrimages in Burma. You might know Maureen. Burma, India, Nepal. Has she also gone to Tibet? I think I said that last night, but I might have... I was correct. Okay, good. I didn't lie. And she's going to be, she just announced last night, she's going to be leading a pilgrimage to Lhasa, which is Lama Zopa Rinpoche's home area in Nepal. It is on the trek to Mount Everest. That's in September of next year. So start climbing hills now. That sounds really wonderful. I wish I was in shape to go do it. Okay, a couple of points. Well, I was going to say our prostration protocol. We'll take our cue from her. Last night she did invite us to prostrate with her. So we'll, if she doesn't invite us again today, then we'll wait until she's seated. We'll have brown bag lunches today and have discussion, or those who wish to can just go take quiet time and contemplate what they've heard this morning. We don't have to discuss, but it's a nice way to spend our time. Reminder to mute or turn off your cell phones. And then also just a reminder that at Kadampa Center, we offer the Dharma free of charge. These teachings are just way too precious to create a financial barrier for anybody to hear them. There are financial realities in bringing Venerable Amy here, though. So if you are moved by what you hear at these teachings, your heart-given donation would be greatly appreciated. We have box right outside the Gampa, a box on the desk near the door, and there's also opportunities to give online. So anything you can give to help make this possible, we appreciate. And I'm expecting she should be here any moment, so we'll just prepare our minds and be ready for her when she comes. Thank you.
Good morning.
I don't know if this is on. Yes, it is. Great. What I thought we could, I'd like to start with, I love that train. No, it initially the first time I taught, I was like, you know, it was right in the middle of a meditation, and I'm like, and now it reminds me of when I was recently running Milarepa Center in Vermont. I left there a couple of years ago, but I was running the center, and in the early days, the first year, when I met Maureen, who was such a huge supporter, amazing. I was there with this wonderful guy named Jeff, who's now a monk, living at Lama Zopa Rinpoche's house in California, helping. And we were really, it was in a rural area, so we were trying to get people to come. It was very challenging, right? Karen remembers, yeah, it's not great to see you. And it was great. So we were trying to do this, and at one point he turned to me, and I was saying about this group, and they never come, and they keep wanting me to drive there, like over an hour away, and then he said, well, they just need to know that the train is leaving the station. Like, we're doing this center, and they're either on it or they're not. So last night somehow that popped him, and the train is leaving the station. Okay. What I thought would be really nice to get ourselves in the mood this morning is to read the Heart Sutra together, okay?
Page 76.
Thank you.
In the Goal Prayer Book. Oh, that's right.
So page 76, if you don't have a copy of the Goal Prayer Book, does anybody need a copy? Everybody okay? Page 76, the Heart Sutra. So this is traditionally read at the beginning of teachings in the Tibetan system, and because it relates to the topic, I thought it would be really good for us to... So, again, when you read, let's read with real thought about what we're saying, thought about the words that we're saying. I prostrate to the Arya Triple Gem. Thus did I hear at one time the Bhagwan was dwelling on Massa Vultures Mountain in Rajgriha together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagwan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom, and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Then through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, how should any son of a lineage train who wishes to practice the activity profound perfection of wisdom? He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Shravadvariputra. Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this, correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness. No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. No visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no eye element, and so on, up to and including no mind element and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to and including no aging and death and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering should be known as truth since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared. Taya ta om gate gate para gate para sam gate bodhisoha. Shariputra, the bodhisattva mahasattva, should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the bodhisattva mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage, it is like that. It is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan, having thus spoken, the Venerable Shravadvariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, and those surrounding in their entirety, along with the world of gods, humans, asuras, and gandharvas, were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. So from there, let's just find a comfortable meditation posture. And lightly close your eyes, taking the gaze inward. And allow a normal, natural breath to move through your system. And using that breath to open up any space in any tight places in your body, allowing them to release as much as possible. Think about the wonderful opportunity we have right now with our precious lives as humans. We can just spend a day thinking, talking, reflecting on emptiness. Unbelievable luxury. Breathe that in, just allowing yourself to fully appreciate the situation you've created for yourself. You can reflect on other positive things in your life, along with the positive qualities you have. And just take a moment to practice gratitude. Because this situation is quickly passing away, let's really direct our energy today as much as we can towards moving us along a path, getting us closer to enlightenment, maybe sharpening any understanding we have about emptiness, helping us find a way to reflect more and study more about emptiness. Developing a practice to meditate on emptiness. Again, that will guide us to enlightenment as quickly as possible so we can be of the most benefit to all others. So take a moment to allow that motivation to sink in to your mind. And in your own way, setting a positive intention right now. So in your own mind, set a good motivation for this class today and all the activities of the rest of your day. Please relax. You can open your eyes. Have any of you been to Bodh Gaya, India? Okay. Did you go to Nalanda?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Rajgir? Okay. So Bodh Gaya, India is where the Buddha got enlightened. It's in the plains of eastern India, in one of the poorest states of India, Bihar. And outside of Bodh Gaya, a couple hours drive, is Nalanda and Rajgir. Okay, Nalanda is the ruins of this extensive monastery that I believe existed from around the second century AD to it disappeared around the 12th century, destroyed from a change in the situation around there like that. And then Rajgir is near there, And it's technically Vulture's Peak. It's a peak that sits up, and you can walk up there. You kind of walk up, and it's a pilgrimage site. Both places are. Nalanda's huge. It's a big park now with uncovered ruins of this old monastery, and you can walk around, and more has been uncovered over the years. You can make pilgrimage there, and so I was had the good fortune again to go back with a group from our center there, Root Institute, in December, and I took a group up to Rajgir, and you walk up, and there's some caves on the way where some of Buddha's disciples meditated. It's very inspiring, and there's all these pilgrimage groups. And you get up there, and we were fortunate. We got up there, and we were in between groups, so you quickly sit down, and everybody wants to read the Heart Sutra there. That's where the Buddha taught the Heart Sutra. So in a sense, you could kind of imagine when you're there, the Buddha sitting there, who's supposed to be larger than other beings, and all around maybe beings kind of crawling out of caves or monastery ruins, listening to this, right? And you can kind of imagine what that would be like. And sometimes I stand up there and I look out at the kind of bush in the area and just think about, you know, what that would be like. If you create the cause to have holy places, monasteries or nunneries, then they exist. And then when the cause is gone, they disappear. They go. You've all created the cause for Gaudama Center to be here. It's really cool. You know, who would have thought in this part of North Carolina, right? And now you have a stupa right by the roadway, and people walk by, and they have no idea the effect it has on them to go by the shrine. Again, whether they believe it or not, but it's like suddenly this cause got created, conditions came together. Look what we have here. It's a beautiful place. Great teachers, and, you know, so it's really interesting to think in your own life, what kind of causes am I creating? What will be the result of what I'm doing right now in my life and creating the cause for? Okay? So it's interesting to think about that. And I love this. So the Buddha talks about, it's all about emptiness. The Heart Sutra is the shortest form of the perfection of wisdom, Prajnaparamita Sutra. So it's in different verses, and I'm going to talk just briefly about that. This Heart Sutra is the shortest form of that. Okay. How's everything? Anybody check out what everything's a product? Anybody playing with that last night and this morning? It's interesting, isn't it? Did you find anything that's not a product? Something to think about? Okay, everything's a product we were talking about. How many were not here last night? So where were you? No. You were in the prison.
Yeah.
Prison visits?
I teach.
Teach at the prison. Wonderful. Thank you. I'm joking. Okay. No, I just wanted to know how much I can should repeat a little bit for people. The lamas tend to give a talk. At the end of it, they wrap up and give a brief summary. And the next session, they do a brief summary. Because usually the third time is when it goes in. Okay? So let me just go through a little bit of... And we're also familiar with the way to listen to the teachings. You've heard of the teaching on the three pots, correct? So what's the teaching? We want to avoid being these pots. What are the three pots?
The upside down.
Okay, there's one upside down, so nothing goes in. You know, you're sitting here and it's just like, boop. Nothing's going in. Spaced out, right? Another pot? Is leaking. Stuff goes in and it goes right out. I've seen people come out of teachings, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and they come out and they go, wow, powerful. And then you go, well, so what did Rinpoche teach? Like, I missed it. And then they're like, I can't really remember, right? Just immediately. Okay, so goes right in, right, and then there's a dirty pot, okay? Dirty pot, you got your mind's consumed with anger. You come in and you're irritated, and that's all that's swimming around your mind. So whatever goes in, it gets contaminated with that. So you want to try to be a, you know, impartial view, open-minded space to hear what's coming in. I'll mention again, I'm just giving you information according to the Gelugpa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. directed today on emptiness, the topic of emptiness, the nature of reality. So if there's something useful for you, great. But you have to make effort, to try the exercises I'll suggest. Try to focus in the meditations. Try to listen well. Something doesn't work for you, just put it to the side. Like that. There will be time for questions. Things like that. Okay? So just as a quick, just a little quick review, I mentioned the context of how emptiness sits in our teachings a little bit last night, according to something called the three higher trainings. Three higher trainings. Okay? I know Buddhism has a lot of the three of this and the six of that and the, you know. Okay. The three higher trainings. Anybody remember? Based on morality. Based on morality. Ethical conduct. You know, you want to conduct yourself well in the world. Why? It makes for a more peaceful mind. Right? If you steal something from somebody, that little niggling negative bubble is going to come. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. Shouldn't have said that. Shouldn't have acted like that. So that's why we want to have a basis of good morality. Then based on that, you can develop, number two, concentration, meditative stabilization. Okay. Why? Because my mind's somewhat peaceful. I'm okay. Right? You know how your mind is when you're doing the right thing, more peace in the mind. So from that you can develop meditative stabilization, concentration. Okay? And then you need that for the third higher training, emptiness. You need shine, the concentration, to develop wisdom, to have a direct perception of emptiness. Okay, because it's done in meditation, and you need to have that penetration to see emptiness directly. Okay, and then I mentioned how it also fits in with the whole context of the teachings that can be brought in and synthesized into something called the three principal aspects of the path. What are those?
Renunciation.
Bodhicitta. Emptiness. Renunciation. Bodhicitta and emptiness, those three topics encompass all the philosophy of the Lam Rim. Okay? Renunciation, more of the person of the lower scope motivation. You know, what am I renouncing? Well, I want to understand that I have a good situation now, perfect human rebirth. Situation's quickly passing away. Death and impermanence. I could fall into lower realms of existence. That terrifies me and motivates me to practice. Okay? And then if I'm going to do that, I'm going to take refuge, which is in a sense entering the sacred door through which the teachings are entered. And then I want to learn how to conduct myself, karma, avoiding 10 non-virtues, adopting 10 ethical guidelines. That's all the lower scope motivation that then leads you in as a being that realizes the suffering in this life is also not okay. So that explores medium scope motivation, all the different ways we suffer, and that there is an end to the suffering and you can reach nirvana. Okay? So all of that would start to kickstart your renunciation once you start to really explore how you suffer. Okay? And then the teachings in the higher scope talk about how to develop the good heart, bodhicitta, the enlightened attitude, and the wisdom realizing emptiness. So it's quite, I was just thinking of, it's beautiful like to go to Rajagir and sit there with the Buddha thinking about what it would be like in those days. And the Landa Monastery is where a lot of these great masters that brought the emptiness teachings to us studied. So you're walking around there. In the first time I went to Rajagir, they hadn't uncovered a lot. And I wasn't impressed at all. I was like, yeah, you know. Anyway, now it's a beautiful park with ruins very nicely shown, you know, huge, some of them. And you really get a sense of the scope of the place. So you can sit there and you can read different teachings of these great masters. And Master Shantideva, Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti, Dharmakirti. I mean, they all were there over the different centuries. Can you imagine? So sometimes I just sit there, walk around, and think about what it would be like. They're all walking around and studying, doing their things. You can see the cells where they lived. Think, and, you know, it's quite an amazing place to visit. So at some point, I hope you can visit there. Oh, you know, I did leave cards. Are all the cards gone?
Yeah.
They're gone. Okay, I think I have more as well. We'll talk about that. Because about pilgrimage, I just wanted to mention, if you weren't here yesterday, I lead pilgrimages, and sometimes, so the next one I'm actually leading I'm giving you lots of notice, is to Laudo. So Laudo is a remote retreat center near Mount Everest, where Lama Zopa Rinpoche has a holy cave. I've done many, many retreats there. His sister is a nun who lives there. It's a very precious place. And if you want to ever do trekking in Nepal or things like that, it's the same thing. It's basically part of the Everest Base Camp trek. And we would fly in together on a little plane that's absolutely terrifying. And no, not really. It's fine. It's just, you know, now the runway is paved. That's exciting. Yep. We used to land and there would be carcasses of planes that didn't make it on the side. Like it was really, in the old days, now it's paved. And then we'll walk anywhere from like 3 to 4 days together, and there's lodges on the way, and it's the most spectacular scenery, unbelievable. And then we're going to do a 4-day retreat at Laudo, and then I'm going to show people where a 2-hour walk away where Rinpoche was born. There's a nunnery in the valley below we'll go to, and there's a cave where a nun lives we're going to visit and just show a little bit of the area, and then you can do your own trekking or do whatever else you'd like to do in the area. So I've now got a slideshow of the walk and Laudo on my website. You can access from here. So I'll leave these here. And then if you're interested, I will have some more info about the pilgrimage, which will be late September, early October 2017. And there'll be more and more information coming in the next month about that. It's a fundraiser for Laudo, so going to bring some people up there. And Rinpoche wanted me to teach up there a little bit in the season, so I'm going to try to go up. Okay, so let me give you the context of the Buddhist teachings on emptiness and how we got going on this. And, okay, the Buddha taught for over 40 years 84,000 different teachings, as most of you are aware of. And they were categorized into three baskets, three tripitaka, they would say. The discipline, the Vinaya, was one of the baskets. The discourses, suttas or sutras, my Sanskrit is not very good, my pronunciation or Pali, and knowledge, Abhidharma. Okay? And then they were also categorized more simply into universal vehicle, Mahayana, or individual vehicle, Hinayana. And so it's interesting, the reason there's 84,000 teachings, there's a lot of different people in this room alone. You all have a different way you synthesize information. Different things you hear, different things that work for you. Okay? So the Buddha gave different teachings, and some people like to get sectarian. Oh, Hinayana teachings, well that's not about enlightenment. Okay? That's useless thinking. Okay? There's different types of people. So it's great that the Buddha gave all these different teachings to accommodate and basically hook certain people with a certain thing. There's certain things that turned you on to Buddhism, and it could be completely different for the person on the other side of the room. So the Four Noble Truths, how the realization of emptiness, it's the actual antidote to the origin of suffering. Okay, the Four Noble Truths started with suffering exists. There is suffering. That was the first teaching the Buddha gave. Emptiness is the antidote to that. So this rips out the root of all the suffering. This is the crux of the whole thing. And I personally find in my own practice, we've got even a preliminary to the Lamrim, technically. Some people say it's the beginning of Lamrim. It's really preliminary. Guru devotion. I'm sure many of you have had teachings on that. Guru devotion. You know, finding the qualified teacher and devoting in the proper way to this person. Why? Because they more quickly will lead you to a direct perception of emptiness, kind of the other end of the Lamrim. So there your bookends. Okay, but all the basic teachings of the Buddha, and if you look at the Lamrim, it's all designed, okay, the Lamrim, if you're new, is our philosophy, stages on the path. I think most of you have been studying that here at this center. But most of the teachings, they're all directed to get you to a direct perception of emptiness. That's how they're designed. Okay. And also, you've heard different words. Emptiness, selflessness, identitylessness. They're all words for the same thing. And there will be times we're talking about things and I will ask you to be specific about your terminology like that. So, there, and as I said last night, I haven't found in other spiritualities, other religions, I haven't found anything that really touches emptiness, that really manifests and moves out the same way the emptiness teachings do. So in the Kabbalah, esoteric side of Judaism, there's some similar concepts, not exactly like emptiness. I know, you know, the Tao Te Ching has some similar things like that, but it's not exactly that I found. And so also, if you've heard about the 12 links of dependent arising, correct? People have heard of those teachings. This takes you through the wheel of life. You see a big tonk on the wheel of life. Okay, outside the door. So that talks about and relates to the 12 links. And the 12 links are rooted. It's about how you come back into cyclic existence, samsara. How do we keep cycling? Why do we keep cycling through this? The root of it is ignorance. So what we're going to be talking about is how to dismantle that. And what is that ignorance? What are we talking about? Okay. Wisdom, which is the antidote, wisdom is basically a mental event that is able to discriminate between what is and what isn't. Okay. Here the discrimination is particular to the way things exist by means of which we may identify and eliminate false appearances that obscure the way they actually exist. We've got a layer of false appearances on something. That's what we interact with due to our ignorance. Okay. And let me just give you once again that definition I mentioned yesterday. Emptiness. Shunyata. Shunyata. Okay. A noun. Emptiness or voidness. Shunyata is a characteristic of phenomena arising from the fact as observed and taught by the Buddha that the impermanent nature of form means that nothing possesses essential, enduring identity. I just wanted to mention that again. I'm just giving you right now a preliminary of where do these teachings come from, who brought them to us, who commented on them, like that. It gives you a little bit about the validity of the lineage. And we're all about lineage in Tibetan Buddhism. So these are teachings I got from my teacher, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and many other teachers who got it from his teachers, His Holiness Trijon Rinpoche, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So, and then you could trace that all the way back to the Buddha, like that. So I'm not saying I'm a Buddha, and I'm delivering it in my limited context of my limited mind, like that. So it's very good to get teachings from many different teachers. Okay. So the interesting thing, I talked about the Heart Sutra. Heart Sutra, the heart, okay? This is the core of the teachings, okay? The essence, I would say. And I mentioned the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, the Perfection of Wisdom teachings were rolled out in many different forms, okay? There was a 100,000 verse form. There's a 25,000 verse form. There's an 8,000 verse form. Heart Sutra is shortest because we just read it in a very short time, okay? If you go to Kathmandu, when you come on our pilgrimage in 2017, okay, in Kathmandu, in the tourist section of Kathmandu, then what I'd like to do is if I have a day before the pilgrimage and people want, I'd love to take people on my walking tour of the tourist area. Because there's all these shops you can buy, really delectable things, okay, but there's also some very, very holy things from this tourist area. There is a Tara statue that has been known to talk to people. There is a thousand arm, a Chenrasig statue. And they're all in kind of Hindu temples and shrines that are all managed now by Nepali Hindus. Very, very holy places. You go and you light butter lamps and make an offering. And then there is the third temple houses what they said was one of the original writings down of the Perfection of Wisdom of the Prajnaparamita in 100,000 verses. It's in massive Tibetan texts when it was first recorded, I guess, by the Tibetans. It's in a trunk. And if you go into the temple, you have to pay so much. It's a fair amount for them to bring it out. I happened to pass by once when a family you know, like a wealthy Tibetan family asked it to be brought out, and they were reading, they read certain verses from it, and then they can touch you on the head with it, and they invited me to come in, and I got bonked on the head with the different things. It's kind of a real, you know, rarity that it happens. So these are things that are right there in the tourist area of Kathmandu, but a lot of people aren't aware of them. So sometimes they called these discourses on the Prajnaparamita the Great Mothers. The Great Mothers. Meaning the three Great Mothers were the 100,000 verse, 25,000 verse, 8,000 verse. Okay? The Mothers, this is what females often associated with wisdom. Prajnaparamita is an actual deity who is female. Okay? So, you know, women power. We've got the wisdom, right? What was that old song, Man Smart, Woman Smarter, or something, right? Okay, the three Great Mothers. And then they were rolled out into different versions as well. The Heart Sutra, you've heard of. You've heard of the Diamond Cutter Sutra, also about emptiness. Okay, so this is how important these teachings are, and the different ways they were. You know, I had an experience when I got ordained, and I asked, and I was told I had obstacles. And it was actually a really cool way that they did it, which is why they told me they had obstacles between Lama Zopa Rinpoche and Chödön Rinpoche, who ordained me. And then when I asked what I could do to clear the obstacles, and I wanted to take ordination the next day, because it was Sakadawa, and Chödön Rinpoche says, you can read the 8,000 verses. I couldn't read that overnight. So I was like, okay. So I got this idea that if I could email, because Lama Zopa Rinpoche tipped me off and said, this is the kindness of the guru. So either you can read, he said, or you can have monks read. Okay? You can get a group of people to read, then quicker. So my mind started, and I thought, if I email Kopan Monastery now, it's Sakadawa morning there, maybe I can make it happen. Okay, but it was really my wish that created, like I really wanted this. So I pursued, I asked again, and said, if I email Kopan, and then Chödön Rinpoche got a big smile on his face, and he said, yeah, really? Okay, right? So then I was in robes the next day, right? But it ended up, it was the nuns at the nunnery that read for me. You know? My sisters at the nunnery, so kind. So that just cleared the obstacle of the wish. So, in the Heart Sutra we just read, Avalokiteshvara, inspired by Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha goes into meditation in the Heart Sutra. Then he moves out the wisdom through Avalokiteshvara. Okay. Who is actually the Buddha of infinite compassion, but in this mode he's like a high level bodhisattva. Okay? So you got him and you got Shariputra, and then he basically disseminates the Buddha's teaching to Shariputra and says, all the Buddhas who dwell in the three times, past, present, future, also completely awakened to unsurpassable, perfect, and complete enlightenment in reliance upon the perfection of wisdom. So you need emptiness to get enlightened. That's what they're saying. You have to have that realization to get enlightened. Five paths to get enlightened. So you want to go through that. Okay? Path of accumulation. Path of preparation. Path of seeing. Path of habituation. Path of no more learning. Okay? And they can go side by side with the bodhisattva bhumis or levels. Okay, until you become a bodhisattva. Okay, but what happens, path of accumulation, let's talk about it. You're accumulating the conditions to see emptiness directly. So a lot of people get into Dharma and stuff, and then we think we're on the path of accumulation. Why? Well, we might be doing some practice. I set up my altar every day. I do my water bowls. I've done some Nundro preliminary practices. Has anybody here done some Nundro? Okay, you know what Nundro are. You're cleaning the way. You know, you're doing a certain number of prostrations or recitations of something or like that. It's fantastic practice. It not only cleans away negativities in your mind stream, it helps you accumulate the conditions you need to get enlightened. So I know a lot of us, when we got around 3-5 years, we were in Buddhism, path of accumulation, but, you know, you're not on the path of accumulation. Okay, until you have actual renunciation. Real renunciation. Anybody know what the real definition of renunciation is? What would you say? Again, renunciation is an attitude. It's not about giving all your money away. That's not renunciation. Okay, if you're still grasping, right? Anybody? Yeah.
You're tired of suffering and you want to get rid of it as quickly as possible.
Yep. So basically, thank you, you're striving day and night to get out of samsara. That's real renunciation. You're striving day and night to get out of samsara. Okay? You're not watching TV series like American Crime. Okay? But you know what I mean? You're really going for it. You're really like, this sucks, and I want to do everything I can to get out of this. I'm tired of this. I've had enough. Okay? Now, we've all had some little bubbles of renunciation come up in our lives, meaning you get tired of a certain negative pattern you're perpetuating, right? People who are recovering alcoholics, recovering addicts and stuff. You had really unhealthy relationships and you finally said, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm taking a break until I can figure out a decent way to do it. We've all had our different experiences like that. You have constant fights and battles with your kids in a certain way and then you go, okay, stop. I got to do this differently. That's a passage of renunciation. Okay. When you have real renunciation, you enter the path of accumulation. I remember I came out of the 7-month retreat at Vajrapani. After I finished being the director, they let me stay and do a retreat there for 7 months. I came out and the community wanted to have dinner with me to hear about any insights I had from retreat. And the first thing I could just think of was I realized I'm not even on the path yet, you know. But it's helpful. Just we're all trying our best, moving, okay? Then, so you're accumulating the conditions. The path of preparation is when you are preparing to see emptiness directly. So this means you've got hours of classes in about emptiness. You've got a very good intellectual understanding of emptiness. You're doing at least an hour every day of emptiness meditation. More and more soaking your mind in the view, in the correct view. Maybe you're serving a center or serving your teacher. In a very pure way. Very good ethical conduct. Very good conditions like this. So these paths take quite a long time to set up. Path of seeing is quicker. You're in meditation. Like that. I've already kind of perfected some other levels in your mind. And you're in meditation when you see emptiness directly. And then many other realizations come at that time. And then what happens in the next path of habituation, you're familiarizing and meditating again and again on what you saw. So it becomes merged more with your mind. After the direct perception of emptiness, and you come out of the meditation, your mind goes back to seeing it the way you used to see it, but now you know. But you're still not seeing everything purely like that. So that's why the path of habituation, you're furthering the meditations and purifying more obscurations to omniscience, which then the final subtle ones are removed on the path of no more learning, the fifth path. So I just wanted to give you a little context of how that fits in. So again, the Heart Sutra, it also says the mantra, the perfection of wisdom. Okay, mantra. Anybody know what mantra means? Okay, manus, mind, tra, protection, mind protection. A mantra is a mind protection. One Lama described it to me, it's like a battering ram, like for the mind. Okay, and when you recite a lot of mantras in retreat and things, it's like it creates this kind of inner reverberation. Okay, here it says, Heart Sutra, the mantra of great knowledge, the protection of the mind that is great knowledge. Okay, the real protection for your mind, great knowledge, is wisdom. The real protection for your mind is wisdom. Okay, and then it goes on, the unsurpassed protection for the mind, unequal to the unequal. Okay, this protection of the mind, the mantra for the protection of wisdom is declared. And then it says, tayata gate gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhi soha. Okay, the wisdom gone beyond, and it talks about the different levels. Part of it relates to the five paths I just mentioned. That's why there's different gates. Then there's, it'll talk about the different scopes of your motivation. That's technically what that mantra relates to. It exists on different levels. Okay. So you've gone beyond the actual way, the mistaken way that we interact with reality. You've gone beyond that with the mantra. We, years ago at Vajrapani, there's a big animal shelter, I think in Utah. We decided to make an offering of $1,000 to save the life of a goat. 1 year we just decided we like to make offerings every year, and we saved the life of a goat, and they sent us a photo of the goat, and it would pay for the food for the lifetime of the goat and all these other things, medical care, and you got to name the goat. So we named the goat Tayata Gate Parasamgati Bodhisoha. And we wrote them a letter and said, thank you so much. And we just said, here, you know, this is the name, because they said, tell us the name. And we said, is there any way somebody could once in a while say that into the ear of the goat? We thought, you know, so they must have thought we were nuts, but so we named the goat. Okay. Sometimes all of this can be synthesized into, because I mentioned 100,000 verses, 25,000 verses, 8,000 verses, Heart Sutra, again, synthesized into Tayata Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgati Bodhisoha, can be synthesized into the syllable Ah. Also down in its most subtle, the syllable Ah. The usual explanation of this is just all the words depend on syllables, all the syllables depend on the expression Ah. They're all a manipulation, all the Tibetan syllables of the sound Ah, and likewise whatever exists is essentially empty of inherent existence. Being empty of inherent existence is one characteristic you find the same within every single phenomenon, that they're all empty of inherent nature. Okay? So awe is, and another level awe is like, you could say the utter relaxation of a yogi or a yogini, kind of expressed when they're experiencing the perfection of wisdom. For me, it's like a transcendental sigh, in a sense, like that syllable ah. In a sense, everything comes from that. Okay, the wisdom that pervades everything. So sometimes they just synthesize it down like that. Okay, after the Buddha gave these teachings, he predicted that some 400 years in the future, Master Nagarjuna would appear to further synthesize the teachings on emptiness. He was very profound in this. Nagarjuna, Naga are snake spirits. Okay, he was said to have basically, a little bit about his life, that he mastered all the Buddhist teachings. He was not satisfied, heard other teachings the Buddha had given. He wanted to like get everything. He met a lord of Nagas. Nagas, they're called like mermaids or mermen, kind of more serpent spirits. They control the water element on the planet. And if you go to Nepal, some places in India, Nepal, but anytime there's a water source or a spring, they hang lots of prayer flags and people make offerings and things to basically pacify the Naga spirits. I know once at Laudo, the young girl who used to live there, she's now a nun at the nunnery, they would cut grass in the autumn to feed the animals for the winter and store it, cutting all this grass, and she would get really sick after it, and I remember Anila, Rinpoche's sister, would say she must have disturbed the Naga that was their belief system. So then they would do a Naga puja to kind of help her get better. Again, it depends what you have faith in. Okay. So the king of the Nagas told Nagarjuna that the Nagas entrusted him with the job of protecting this Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, and then they gave him this name, Nagarjuna, like that. That was how he got the name. They invited him to their realm, and he went there and brought back this sutra and then wrote famous commentaries to the sutra, like that. He was also born into a Brahmin high caste family in India, Nagarjuna. Had many life obstacles as a young child, had to do retreat before the age of 7 so he could just survive to the age of 8. A little different than our lives, would you say? Right? And then basically lived a long life, became the abbot of Nalanda Monastery, the one I mentioned outside of Bodh Gaya. He's the great kind of purveyor of the middle way, Madhyamaka school of Buddhism that we hear, particularly about the perfection of wisdom, Madhyamaka. Okay? If you're a follower of that school, you're a Madhyamika. Okay? Madhyamaka, middle way school. Middle way school. Let's see. There's supposedly, I don't think I've been to this temple. In the Kathmandu Valley is another, there's two very holy stupas. One is called Bodha or Bodhanath, which is just down the hill from Kopan Monastery in the town of Bodha. It's almost a city block big. Big stupa. It was damaged in the earthquake, and last fall they were putting it back together. Across town is the Swayambhu Nath or Swayambhu Stupa on a big hill. Beautiful, beautiful place. The area around it apparently was damaged, where there's shops and buildings. I think the stupa there was okay. And it's also known as the Monkey Temple because there's lots of monkeys that live there. There's a big Korwa walkway around the bottom of it. You can also walk around the top. There's a huge staircase going up to it. And so there is a small Nepali temple in that area of the Swayambhuna that's said to have a doorway that leads to the Naga realm, like that. Leads down under the hill. And they say this is where Nagarjuna went to meet them to retrieve the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, like that. One of his famous books, Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way, and he talks about, I prostrate to the perfect Buddha, the best of teachers, who taught that whatever is dependently arisen, whatever is arises dependently, that means on other things, is unceasing, unborn, unannihilated, not permanent, not coming, not going, without distinction, without identity, free from conceptual distinction. It's a little bit similar to the Heart Sutra, no eye, no nose, no tongue. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. So he very much brought in dependent arising, which is one side of the coin, and then the other side is emptiness. You never have emptiness without dependent arising. Okay? Dependent arising means, okay, let's look at this for a little bit. Things arise in dependence on other things. Things arise, they come into being by depending on other things. You have to think about it. I said everything's a product yesterday. Okay. Everything you look at in this room right now, you yourself are a product of other things. So we don't want to just think of things lacking inherent existence and throwing everything out and ending up with nihilism, that nothing exists. Things do exist, but how do they exist? Well, they exist by depending on three things. This is what the idea of dependent arising talks about. What are the three things? Number one, they depend on causes and conditions. What does that mean? Okay? It means that there's an idea. If I take this table right now, Lama Zopa Rinpoche used to teach, and Rinpoche changes his teachings, I notice, every few years. I mean, the same teachings, but he'll use different examples to try to get at our minds. We get tired of the table, okay? But he used to always use the table. I always remember, so there's a table. I mean, for years there was a table. And then I remember one of my girlfriends one time, it was like 7 hours on the table. Really, it was one teaching about Japan. It went on for 7 hours in the old days before Rinpoche manifested a stroke. It was a table. And then what happens is he went through this whole teaching, but then he came back again after several hours and said, so there's a table. And my friend just went like, oh, I can't take it anymore, you know. Okay? But if you look at the table, the cause and condition for the table to be here is people started wanting something to put something on. They started using things like that. Before, people sat on the ground in the dirt and didn't use tables. But then suddenly they wanted a surface that was a little bit higher than what they had. It's a beginning cause and condition. If you want to fast forward to modern days, somebody had an idea to make money and have a factory that would mass produce tables. Right? Or you go to a furniture store and there's dining room tables and kitchen tables and desks and things like that. Because somebody's like, well, people use this and they want to sit like this. We started to be a culture that used chairs to sit, and then you need something at that level. And then tables evolved, depending on that cause and condition. Everybody get it? Understand, right? Here's second way, second cause. of the idea, the philosophy of dependent arising. Things depend on their parts to exist. They depend on their parts to exist. In fact, they cannot exist without their parts. Okay? Parts of the table. Okay? In order for it to really be a table, it needs legs. So tables have. It needs a top. It needs a surface. This particular table is made of wood. It's painted in a certain way. And if you want to get more subtle, there's molecules moving around in a certain configuration. In this configuration, they're moving around more slowly. That's why it's solid. Solid table. And you can get more elaborate. It can have a shelf, and it can have, and I can even say this is the top of the table. If I point underneath, it's the bottom of the table. This is the side. I could say this is the front of the table. This is the back. This is the side. Everybody following me? Parts of the table. Okay. Third way, the highest school, Prasangika Madhyamaka, says that the way the table comes into existence is that my mind takes in a certain information, the data that's out there. Legs, top. My eye consciousness interacts with that if it's out there, because I'm not touching it, I'm just looking. My eye consciousness takes in the data that's out there. Okay? Being a person in the United States with a certain language in this place in the country, I look at that information. My mind takes in that data. Okay? And then there's a labeling process. There's a labeling process by the mind. And my mind labels table on the data that I've just seen. Everybody following? My mind labels on the table. Okay? So there is a mental imputation, a designation on what's there, and that's how the thing comes into existence. Okay? I'm going to go more into this. I just want to give you some ideas. And the kind of neat thing was Nagarjuna took the emptiness teachings, Prajnaparamita, studied it intensively, thought, reflected, meditated. You know, this is about listening, reflecting, and meditating. This is our path. You come to teachings, you hear first. Okay? Then I'll ask you to reflect a little bit on something. So you want to, a little bit, instead of at a break, lunch break, whatever, you start blah blahing, I want you to reflect more deeply. That's what you want to talk about in your conversations. You know, about these teachings. So it takes it to a deeper level. Then you want to meditate on it, which we're going to do later today. You need to meditate on it. So it goes even deeper into that. So through this, he came out with his commentaries. And one of his root verses on wisdom is a small book. It was mainly written for scholars. Madhyamaka Vatara, mainly written for scholars, okay? So they would chew up these pieces, and then they would come up with their commentaries. Lama Tsongkhapa many years later, okay, many centuries later. So this is for you as well. Any of you can do this. You want to synthesize any of the Dharma teachings you get. Some of you are probably already doing this, okay? So then you study the DB courses, the modules. Right? You complete those different courses, then you teach, okay? Then when you teach, you basically understand you need to know more than the students to teach. You need to have synthesized some of it for yourself to understand. And then you start discussing with other people who teach as well to kind of further work it out. And then you write your own commentaries. Right? But it's true. You can do this. You can do this. You want to make it real for you. It's not like the Dharma's out there. Okay? It really has to become part of your kind of life thing. And it's so cool that centers like this exist. And you've got this huge community, and it's just glorious, I think. So slowly come to it. Now granted, you've got your lives, you've got your work, you've got your families, but figure out a way that it's really going to be practiced and worked in your life, that you're really going to be digesting some of this, cooking it, okay? Because it's going to make you happier and more peaceful. So another book, I'm just mentioning different books. This is one that's very accessible to us, Echoes of Voidness. Echoes of Voidness by Geshe Rapton. It was one of the early books that came out, translated by Stephen Batchelor, great Buddhist scholar, okay? It has three very different styles of text on the subject of emptiness. It's a great one to get for the library here, Echoes of Voidness. Okay, and what it moves out is the Buddha's heart of perfection of wisdom. So the Heart Sutra is part of it, and there's a whole commentary on that in there, very nice. Commentary by Geshe Rapton. Another is a chapter on Master Chandakirti's great commentary known as a supplement to Nagarjuna's fundamental text on wisdom. Okay? So some years later, Chandrakirti came. Okay? Nagarjuna was 2nd century. Chandrakirti was 7th century. So he came along 7th century, Nalanda Monastery, and he goes, well, what's this stuff from Nagarjuna? What's he saying? Then he had different things that he rolled out. And then, so it's got Master Chandrakirti's piece, and then there's the root text for the Galupa oral tradition by Panchen Losang Choki Gyaltsen. And so it talks about the different things. We've heard of Introduction to the Middle Way, and which has 10 chapters. Each chapter describes the practices of a bodhisattva according to the 10 stages of the development of bodhisattva, the 10 bhumis I mentioned. And the 6th stage of development is where they perfect the training on the perfection of wisdom. So that's how those two, the bodhisattva bhumis, move along with the 5 paths to enlightenment. That would be around when they get the perfection of seeing emptiness directly. So just giving you the context of that. So basically, the Buddha predicted Nagarjuna would come 400 years later to elucidate a more subtle view on emptiness, Madhyamaka, and then within that, different schools developed further commentary from Buddha Palita, 5th century, Master Chandrakirti, 7th century. Okay, and then we're going to bring forward to Lama Tsongkhapa, our patron saint of the Galupa tradition. Okay, lived 1357 to 1419, founded Ganden Monastery, which is outside of Lhasa, Tibet, now being rebuilt, and then reestablished in South India when the Tibetans exiled in 1959 under the communist Chinese. Lama Tsongkhapa, I think you're quite familiar with him, a Buddhist saint, unbelievable philosophical master, genius, unbelievable. He was one, when we do Nundro, maybe somebody wants to try to do 100,000 prostrations. Maybe they'll try to do 100,000 mandala offerings, which creates prosperity and the causes of the Dharma flourishing. So he did like 1 million or 3 million prostrations, 1 million, while he was writing commentaries, you know, and meditating like that. Unbelievable being. You can go to Ganden Monastery, you can visit his retreat room where he lived. Very inspiring. When he passed away, they did not cremate him. They kept his body in a glass case, wrapped like that, which they do sometimes for very holy beings. His hair and nails kept growing. Body was wrapped like this, supposedly. And subsequent Dalai Lamas would come and clip some of the nails and hair to make medicine over the years. When the communist Chinese invaded in the 50s, they were destroying a lot of monasteries on the ground. 6,000 monasteries, nunneries were destroyed. So the people of Amdo region, eastern Tibet, which is where Lama Tsongkhapa is from, just like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, they decided to surround Ganden on the ground. They said, we at least have to save Ganden. Like everything else is being destroyed, we'll at least save Ganden. They surrounded it, but the Chinese bombed it, destroyed it. So the last time I was there was 2001, and it was a third rebuilt at that point. So maybe, and now they're making them tourist sites, the monasteries. The monks there are really not free, and what the Chinese do to try to break the spirit is the Chinese make very nice roads and infrastructure and telecommunications, water systems, but the road into the monastery is unpaved. They were still carrying water, had minimal electricity, just to, you know, and they're very monitored and things like that. And there's many less monks there now than there used to be at all the monasteries. So it's kind of like a shadow of what was being practiced before. Some of them end up still trying to escape so they can really study in India and really get all the teachings. Now the borders have been, they're very heavily monitored, so they're not able to escape as much as they were before. So the monastery is now in South India where they've been reestablished, like Drepung Gundan, Sarah. Sarah, where Geshe Gelug and Geshe Tsongpo are from. They are having attendance problems. The population is going down at the monastery for newer monks because the Tibetans are unable to come out. They're getting more people now from India, parts of India, Sikkim and places like that. And Buddhism is booming in India now. It's finally come home, and now the Indians are becoming Buddhists. Very interesting how migrations are happening. But they are having challenges, and they're also having challenges because the education is not as modern, and young men want to have a more modern education. So their monasteries are looking at introducing more science and math and things like that, and making it a more modern education with maintaining the philosophy. So it's a challenge. It's a big challenge. Okay. So Lama Tsongkhapa came along, studied the various masters of ancient India, and categorized them according to the differences in their interpretations of Nagarjuna. Okay. He developed the classification of the Madhyamaka school, which was the school of Nagarjuna, into two sub-schools, Svatantrika Madhyamaka, a centrist who assert, and these are going to get into bigger words, autonomous syllogisms, and Prasangika Madhyamaka, who assert like the consequential school, they'd say. Okay. I'll give you just a quick thing about syllogisms, consequence like that. A syllogism, like deductive reasoning, how you'd get to certain interpretations of emptiness in which a conclusion is drawn, whether validly or not. For instance, all dogs are animals. All animals have four legs. Therefore, all dogs have four legs is a way you'd start to move through emptiness teachings. A consequence is a result of something. So in regard to, if we're going to look at emptiness as a negation, I'm going to get into later, a negation, something that's not there, okay? And one says a Buddhist should not, for instance, this would be the consequence way, a Buddhist should not drink alcohol. So they're not affirming, they're not saying that a Buddhist should drink something else, they're just saying a Buddhist shouldn't drink alcohol. So again, don't worry if you don't understand all this, this is getting into more of the details. And I'm not going to go heavily into those kind of things. It's kind of like another level course. I didn't know if that was going to benefit everybody here. So, okay. So then later, I mentioned Chandrakirti came, Baba Viveka or other teachers that went on with different commentaries. And it's interesting at some point to do, some of you have done the course in tenets with Geshe-la. So you study all the different views they have, and it's helpful to look at some of the schools of tenets. These are the four philosophical tenets. Each school says something different about emptiness, and each one gets more and more subtle. The lower two schools mainly are more of a Hinayana approach. The higher two schools are a Mahayana approach. Okay, and it's very subtle points are made. Let me just give you a quick. Okay, this is the real 25-cent tenet course. We don't have time for the whole tenet. Tenets is very interesting. It's very nice also, very much relates to emptiness, to walk around a little bit in the different shoes of the different schools. You know, like what's it like to be a mind-only person for a while? Okay, so let me just give you a quick thing on some of the schools. Number one school, Vaivashika. Vaivashika school. Particulars is what it means in Sanskrit, particulars. For them, ultimate reality, and this is all about dissecting, understanding ultimate reality or conventional reality. Ultimate reality, really, what really exists, is that which cannot further be broken into parts. That which cannot further be broken into parts. Okay? They believe in something called a partless particle. And that to them is what exists. Okay, that truly exists. Truly exists. So think about a partless particle for a moment. This is something that has no parts. Can you conceive of it? Something that has no parts. Right? Like even if you have this particle, there's sides of the particle, right? There's, you know, So it's like to conceive of this, but they say there is a fundamental building block there. That's what exists. Okay. Of course, those smallest particles and moments of consciousness exist objectively from their own side. Even their collections are the cause of our states of mind. That's what the Vaivashika school says. There is a fundamental thing there. Okay. The I, if you want to take the self, the I that exists for them is the continuity, okay, of our body and mind, okay, or for the mental consciousness as the body dies, okay, because we're made up of five aggregates, body and mind. One form aggregate, our body. Four mental aggregates, our mind, okay, and they say that this continuity is what exists as the I. The one that doesn't exist is a dominant I. You know, sometimes you get a sense of a self-sufficient, substantially existent I. A self-sufficient, substantially existent I. For them, they refute that. That doesn't exist. So each one, you really want to take this in tenets, right? It's quite complex to study. I'm just giving you a quick thing. Don't worry if it's... Okay. Second school, they followed sutras, the second school. Saltrantika. Okay? You want to pronounce it well. Trantika. Sutra. Okay? Because some people mix up Svatantrika. That's different. Okay? Saltrantika. Very similar to the previous school. Except for them, only the first moment of perception is direct. Okay? And they say the second moment of perception is conceived as a mental image. Okay, so for them, only the first moment of perception is what they consider existent, truly existent. First moment is always impermanent, whereas the following moments of a perception are said to be more permanent as a mental image, a concept not changing moment to moment. Those smallest first moments of consciousness and smallest particles exist from their own side, objectively. So they do say there's this fundamental thing that does exist, and the I that exists for them is similar to the previous school. However, some of them say the one aggregate of mental consciousness, they say that's what exists, is that would be the main thing that exists, is the mental consciousness does exist. Number three, Chittamatran, mind-only school. You're getting a little bit more subtle now, mind-only school. For them, there's no partless particles. I mean, that's not something that exists, a partless particle, ultimately. Because they say you can break a particle down indefinitely, continue to break a particle down. For this school, these particles are not causes of our perceptions. They're produced by karma. The mind produces a subjective consciousness and its apprehended object simultaneously. So you've got the mind doing its perception of something, and at the same time it perceives something, that happens at the same time. It's not one moment my mind looking at something and then labeling onto something out there. That happens at the same time. The particles do not exist in a nature separate from the mind. Everything is mind. Like in the example of a dream, but the mind exists from its own side. That's what they would say. The mind exists from its own side. The mind is findable. Okay, this will make more sense a little bit later. The mind is findable. It's a stream of moments of consciousness. Mind-only school. The mind that exists for them is the mental consciousness. Okay? And they would also call it sometimes a mind basis of all. There's an alaya vijnaya, like a storehouse consciousness, and that's what exists for them. The thing that doesn't exist for them is the way it is in the previous schools. What they say exists, mind only says it doesn't exist. The middle way school, Madhyamaka, ultimately nothing is findable. So this is the most subtle. Ultimately nothing is findable. Matter and mind can be broken down indefinitely, on and on and on. So ultimately, nothing is found. I think Einstein knew about this. Yeah. So we knew when I was a kid, the atom was the smallest thing, right? Well, now we know they've broken that down. So there's quarks. Now there's even something smaller than quarks. Small. They're going to keep breaking it down. They have these particle accelerators, right? So there's a nun in our tradition that I helped with the San Francisco Center with her for 3 years. A very good friend of mine in the California, San Francisco Bay Area. She was an engineer working on one of these accelerators in Berkeley for many years as a nun. Okay, breaking down minute particles. They're going to keep, and Einstein kept saying they can just all be further broken down. Like you're never going to find anything there. Keeps breaking down. Something to think about. Okay, the Madhyamaka is broken, is subdivided into Prasangika, the consequentialists, and then Svatantrikas, called autonomous school. Okay, Prasangika view is this is the way Lama Zopa Rinpoche teaches according to the most subtle highest school, Prasangika Madhyamaka. And this is the one where your mind interprets something, perceives something, based on the karmic seeds in your consciousness, okay, you're then placing a label on that. You're synthesizing it in a certain way, designating something on that, and then the thing comes into being. Like that. When you actually ultimately analyze the thing, there's nothing there ultimately. And that's what freaks us out, because you're like, but I am here. Conventionally, you are here. So we're going to get into conventional and ultimate truth a little bit later. The Svatantrika school is further broken down. I'm not going to get into all the different categories of that. It's quite complex. And it's nice to kind of take some time and really go through. I'm kind of really abbreviating this. The schools, the four philosophical tenets. I just wanted to give you some idea of the different terms and things like that. Okay. So that's a little bit of a background. Lama Tsongkhapa had disciples, followers. Kadrip Jay, Gyaltsub Jay we're most familiar with, which are the two that are the statues next to him. One is an older, more wisely sage man. One is a younger, looking a little bit more wrathful. And they both ended up, through their like fierce debating and things like that, ended up also studying and bringing up more philosophies on emptiness like that. So it talks about kind of Lama Tsongkhapa's contribution. He had a special understanding of Master Chandrakirti's teachings. Not all of his contemporaries in Tibet agreed with him like that. So it was a great way through their philosophy of how they debated different things so that they could further work on the commentaries to get clear on how things really existed. So we're going to understand why is it important to know how things exist. So I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. Let me just see, just bringing this up to current time. My introduction, Kopan Monastery, 1987, and this is how the teachings now come to you from my teachers, okay? So, a little bit. I think it's nice sometimes just think about who were the masters that brought us these teachings like that. So, one thing I want to say, in order to realize emptiness, you have to be determined. It doesn't just happen by itself. I'm sorry. The determination gives you tremendous strength. So please cultivate this determination in you. Really develop a conviction that how can I structure my life so that I can get more time to study or do this practice or do that. You can change up your practice over time. As I mentioned last night, you plateau sometimes at 15 or 20 years and things get stale and you want something. So change up your practice. I just kind of reoriented my practice a little bit. I was in retreat in Vermont for a couple weeks just now. So all of a sudden I was kind of like, I think I want to do more of this right now. So now I have a half an hour of that going on. Like it's a little harder to get it all in sometimes, but I'm seeing the value of it. I'm seeing how it's kind of refreshed my practice right now. So because of that, I like it. So it's important. So now it's a priority in my morning schedule. It's working. It's starting to become a habit. Where what that means for me is I'm not going to allow these other distractions to come in and suddenly I don't have time for that. Don't we do that a lot? Like I really want to get up and I'm going to do my practice. I'm going to have my half an hour or however long you have, right? But suddenly now this other thing, this is kind of more fun, and I'm just going to do those emails quickly because I need to tell them that I'm coming or what I'm doing, and then there goes your hour. So for me now, I'm like, I'm gonna get this in regardless, and so just see what you can change up to do it. You can even kind of have a thing, I must do this, but I must get this realization, I must do this before I die. You know, what do you want to do before you die? Kinds of things. If you want to prioritize, write it down. You know, people have bucket lists, right? I was just teaching a course on death and dying. People have bucket lists. I ask people to start a bucket list. What that means is everything you want to do before you die. Right? That's the conventional bucket list. I ask them to also add, what kind of qualities would you like to develop in yourself? Most people don't think about that on the bucket list. What kind of qualities would you like to develop? So here's the second thing. What do you want to do with your practice? Is any of that on your bucket list? This is just you getting real with your life. What are you doing? Last night I asked you, what are you doing to be happy? What are you doing? I mean, talking about to be deeply, long-lasting happy. Are you putting enough pieces into that formula for that puzzle to get solved? Or is it all just the here and now? Right? You had a lot of here and now in past lives, right? How much of it do you remember? But the realizations in your consciousness, that's the thing that's going to go on. That's the thing that's going to come up next life. Okay? Questions? Any questions? Okay. We're just going to do a little meditation. Just find a comfortable position. There's no place in the teachings where it says that the realization requires three countless eons. Okay, you can actually get this before then, depending on your interest, your effort. You know, so why not gain this realization before you die? Totally possible. So just bring your awareness to your breath. Allow the mind to settle. Reflect on the fact right now that you are suffering. In one way or another. We have, for instance, very tangible sufferings of a headache or an illness. Issues with partners or kids or bosses or financial problems. And then we have the more subtle sufferings of certain qualities, personality traits we have we'd like to change. Other more subtle things in our mind that cause problems. Have a look right now. Just take a couple of minutes. You could look at a couple of the sufferings. What's the cause of those sufferings? Can you find an origin of them? What if somebody gave you a pill that said this would completely eliminate the suffering? It would go after the original cause of the suffering. You would want to take it, wouldn't you? Somebody offers you a pill, okay? So the swallowing of this pill, beginning to take this medicine, just think about your path now, is listening intently and showing up for these teachings with a variety of different teachers, keeping your mind and heart open. This is what the pill is doing for you. Allowing ideas to resonate within you. Capturing the ideas, so not forgetting them. Merging them more and more with your mind. Following the lines of thought presented by certain teachers. And also being aware of different ideas that arise within you as you listen to the teachings. You've taken this pill. This is the process that's now unfolding inside of you. As the medicine is dissolving, think of the effort, okay, that unfolds. The pill seems simple, but think of the effort that goes into the things I just mentioned. How the teachings begin to take hold in your consciousness. Imagine an understanding forms, and you begin to immerse yourself in the understanding. Maybe you're struggling with reading some books on emptiness. So maybe you recite some Manjushri mantras every day, a little practice, praising Manjushri, asking for help to deepen your wisdom. There's some other practices you can do. Does it start to open your heart and mind to have a clear and clear understanding? What effort are you making in that regard? Imagine the medicine spreading out through your whole system, body and mind, having its effect. This is the Dharma. So think about it. If somebody gave you a pill, offered you a pill that would keep you young forever, you would never have arthritis, never have a wrinkle, would make your mind completely clear, you would have an amazing memory. Wouldn't you completely take that pill? So this pill of the Dharma, this medicine of the Dharma, this is about your mind. So take just for a moment, think of the qualities, whether it's the Buddha, Master Nagarjuna, Master Chandrakirti, Lama Tsongkhapa, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Just reflect for a moment. Whatever you know about them, wouldn't you want to take a pill that gets you their qualities? Please relax. You can open your eyes. Sometimes I find it helpful to reflect a little bit like that, because we feel like enlightenment is way out there, and that's not for me. But relate, like the Buddha was an ordinary person at one point. His Holiness the Dalai Lama once talked at a teaching I was at when he said he had a memory that he was an ordinary poor Indian at the back of a huge mass audience when the Buddha was teaching. And that really struck me, because, you know, I just thought, I don't think he was ordinary, you know, but the fact that he could be in that form as this poor, like, I thought it gave me hope. Like, here I am, just some, you know, little American person sitting here. So it is like we're taking steps. So you want to try to have it a little bit motivate your practice. It's possible. Possible. Okay? What I'd like to do before lunch, I know we just have a short time here, want to review a little bit and do some Shine meditation. Okay, a lot of you are familiar with concentration. Okay, but you need this to develop emptiness. So we're not really in a retreat mode, but let's just practice a little bit of concentration meditation. Concentration. Okay, what I'd like you to do, I'm going to give you an object on which to meditate. Do some of you do this every day, Shine? Do some concentration every day? Okay, great. Some people knew. What you want to do, you choose an object on which to meditate. Choose an object. We often choose an object, an image of the Buddha, because they say it's uplifting for the mind. But you can choose any object. And don't obsess about an object in your own practice, because it's not from the object's side that you're developing concentration. It's from the mind side. From the mind side. So what you're going to do is you're holding a mental image. If you have a photo of the Buddha, no problem. You look at the photo for a little while. Then you're going to close your eyes and bring up the image in your mind. You're not doing Shine looking at an image. It's in your mind. So if it's too detailed, focus on the eyes first, knowing the whole body's there. Focus on the face. Okay? But I'm going to choose a radiant golden drop of light right here, right outside the nostrils. Tiny radiant golden drop of light here. I'm just going to ask you to try that. Okay? And what you're going to do is a part of your mind, when you close your eyes, part of your mind is going to hold the drop. You're going to stay focused on the drop. Another part of your mind is going to check how you're holding the drop. Meaning, is it clear? Is it focused? Is my mind stable on the drop? As you do this longer and longer, and I'm sure you know if you've been meditating a bit, you start to notice, you start to get a sense of your mind, right? So I know if I'm about to lose my object, the object's starting fuzzy, fuzzy, fading, fading, I'm going to, with my mind, tighten my hold on the object. A little sharper pull. Sometimes you're holding too tightly, the object's like pops out and it's gone and I'm off into some other thought. Okay. Then you want to relax. You get the sense of relaxing your mind. This only comes in meditation, how you start to understand how I'm holding something, how my mind, what my mind's doing at any time. There is a space of awareness there. That's your mind. Okay? So, we're going to hold the mind can do these two things, right? On the object, and then you're checking. How am I? What's the intensity of the meditation? How am I holding? Okay? You want to have clarity in the intensity. Okay? Then what you're doing, if you lose the object three or more times, so once you get to three times, then just take your mind off the object. Relax your mind. Just sitting quietly where you are. Open your eyes. Look around the room 10 or 20 seconds. You don't need to move. Close your eyes, back on the object, and begin again for the remainder of the segment. What's very helpful is to start with a determination. Start with a determination. I'll say the determination in the beginning, meaning I'll say, for the next 5 minutes, think, I am going to keep my mind on this object without my mind wandering. And then you begin. Okay? So just look for a moment. Shine takes an incredible concentrated effort from your mind to stay on the object. Okay? It takes a lot of effort till you get to very high stages, 9 stages of Shine. Through, I believe, about the 7th stage, it takes a great deal of effort to stay on the object. Okay? But it does come from a relaxed space of mind. You can't just plunk yourself down, come home from work, plunk yourself down on the cushion. You know, I've seen a lot of Westerners, we start retreat and they're all, you know, it's not. One of my lamas, Reba Rinpoche, said, meditation comes organically when you thoroughly disengage your nervous system. Thoroughly disengage our nervous system. Well, that may not be possible for us in our world right now, but still, that's why, like, I first sit, and sometimes I'll just sit for a few minutes. How's my mind today? What's happening? Oh, I'm really tight right now. I'm agitated about the conversation I have with so-and-so. Or, I feel pretty good. It's nice to just have a little... I usually get this in the morning waking up. How's it going? Right? It's me and my mind every morning. It's me in the same mind. And every day my mind's different, right? Don't you notice? In retreat, I might do several sessions in retreat in one day. Every session my mind's kind of different. Sometimes there's stability. A few sessions going along, great. You know? Then one session, mind completely uncooperative. So your wisdom is, what do I want to do in that session? You can keep forcing a meditation, but when it's not working, it's not working. So I stop, all of a sudden I'm like, this is not working. Can't, you know, you try for a while. Okay, not what happening? I'm going to read this prayer. I really like this. I'm going to read this. That's how you develop your wisdom in your sessions. It's, you know, I got sick on retreat at one point. I just ended the session early at night, went to bed early. It's your rules, how you're going to work with your mind. You first need to get to know your mind. So that means you need to have an active, consistent meditation practice. Please find a way to do that. Start with short segments. Start a little bit. If you like 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes at night and you see the benefit, then you might lengthen it the next month to 15 minutes. Be wise with yourself. Do something that you're going to do rather than saying, oh, I should have an hour in the morning. And it's always weird when people say, how long do you sit and practice? There's no length of time. It's different for everybody. Everybody's lives are different. Do what you're actually going to get to do that's going to get you to take that medicine. Rather than you see the pills, there they are in the county, one day, yeah, I'll do it. You never do it. Okay? So then what you're doing, this is Shine. You're following a thread, the tracks. You got train tracks. You're on the track of your concentration. Here come the distractions, and you stay right here. Okay, concentrated, firm, right there. Okay? We're going to try our best. Okay? We've got 5 minutes. And just think of the great thing is I'm going to use this one day to meditate and have a direct perception of emptiness. I'm going to develop this concentration. Just find the comfortable posture for your body And again, in a chair, have your feet straight down. If you don't have to lean so heavily against the back of the chair, that's great. Place a little radiant drop of light outside the nostrils. Bring all of your attention there. And think for the next 5 minutes, I am going to keep my mind on this object without my mind wandering. And begin.
Please relax. You can slowly open your eyes. Five minutes is quite short. It's a great starting point to do a little concentration. So a lot of people, when they start a meditation practice in the morning or whenever you get to it, it's nice to get the posture, the body, get the posture of the mind, so you set a good intention. You might start with a little breathing meditation. You can do things like the 9-round breathing. Some people familiar with that. Clears out the channels a little bit. And then I like to start with a little shine, just to kind of every day have a little concentration. But again, start with short segments. But if it's going better, can do a longer segment. But don't start setting up where you're going to concentrate for half an hour, and you're not. So 5 minutes. Great. Open your eyes. Stop. Determination again. Now I'm going to do another 5 minutes. Off you go. Try and slowly it'll build over time. In the beginning it's hard to stay on the object at all. And then slowly it increases the time on it. And helpful? Like that? A little bit? Yes. Question?
I was just wondering, is there a fundamental difference between that and holding the breath as the object? Are they the same thing? Should you do both? Or?
Yeah, if you're going to do shina, you got your mind on one thing at that time. And eventually what happens is later today we're going to try emptiness meditation. So when you get to a certain point, and it could be any part of the philosophy, you're meditating on death, let's say, and suddenly you get a feeling here, I'm going to die. But, you know, you get this aha moment. What you do then, that's through analytical meditation. Okay. Then you take your concentration and apply it to that experience so it deepens the realization. You hold your concentration on that experience, that awareness, as long as you can, and then it fades. Then you go back and analyze again until you get to the place. So when you get to the emptiness meditation, and let's say you come to this not finding, okay, you want to apply your concentration there. So that's how we combine those. So you're doing one thing at a time. In our tradition, for some reason, we don't use the breath a lot as a thing. However, if you're very distracted, go back to the breath, meaning you're going to focus on a little space outside the nostrils where the air enters in and leaves the body, or you're focusing on the rising and falling of your abdomen. Stay with one of those only. Like that, but we don't usually use that to get shine, I would say. I don't hear many people using that. And I also have heard more recently that there's shine that we do kind of in our normal everyday practices. And it does give the mind an exercise of developing concentration, no doubt. Okay? When you start to really progress in your Dharma career, and maybe you get a tantric initiation. Some people have tantric initiation? Okay. So you start to practice tantra, you're doing a certain, what's called a method of accomplishment. Sadhana. Method of accomplishment. It's a certain based on a deity, their world system visualization. You do this practice, maybe every day, and it has a variety of practices in it. Okay. And then through that, you are building this experience in your life through a generation stage of tantra, generating a certain thing, and then through a completion stage where you're using the subtle energy system in the body. So recently I'd heard that better to really get shine using the subtle energy system, focusing on that in a certain way, and that was interesting for me. They said it's easier there to do that. But in any event, we want to practice. We have to practice with the concentration. So this is all a rehearsal. And those of you that play musical instruments, those of you that have ever performed sports over time, you rehearsed, right? You practiced. That's how you got good at it. So this is our mind again. So usually the breath is a great one to go back to, but you might try some other things, and eventually using an image of the Buddha, some people use the nature of mind, as their object of concentration. That's a little bit more subtle, so you need to understand, try to find that space of awareness. Some people use emptiness. That's another one you could do. But that's, again, once you're kind of at this for a while, like that. Any other questions, comments? Yes.
I was finding that, I don't know whether maybe it's because the object is so small, or...
The little golden?
Yes, yeah. Oh, because maybe it's just too small, the object. But I was finding it very hard for me to even, you know, like, imagine it, you know?
Uh-huh.
And then as I was trying, I could even feel my face scrunching up. You know, and then I'm holding my breath, so I'm really trying to get there and stuff.
Right.
So, can I use something bigger?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the other thing is some people have a great deal of difficulty with visualization, and there is a lot of visualization in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. So, what I did is I started with an apple. That was so familiar to me, right? Like, the pictures of the deities weren't familiar to me when I started. So an apple, I could get that. Now, I have no difficulty with visualization. It's easy for me. But through purification practices, there are many of them, people have gotten help with visualization. They don't visualize well, but they've cleaned away some things, and then they're able to visualize a little better, and they keep working at it. So if you want to try something bigger, the other thing people do is if they're losing the drop, they're able to get the drop, but they're losing it, brighten the intensity of the drop. Make it brighter. That sometimes holds people. And just relax, because these are standard obstacles. So I would just be like, just relax. And then sometimes the drop comes in. If it doesn't work, try something else. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so it's lunchtime. Okay, now we're not going to blah blah at lunch, okay? Because we got work to do. This is a short weekend, okay? Why don't you discuss, if you're with other people, the value of the lineage and the teachers? Is it a qualified path? What do you think about that in general? Okay. What about your personal goals and where liberation and omniscience fits in with maybe developing a practice on meditating on emptiness or understanding emptiness or studying any other parts of the philosophy? How's that going in your life? Be somewhat revealing with other people. It's okay to talk about it because other students help other students to say, hey, here's what worked for me. This was working for me. So a little bit, what are your personal goals as far as life objects? But what about your Dharma career? What about your Dharma career? That'd be something worthwhile, I think, to talk about at lunchtime, like that. And what I'd like to do is also offer our lunch, if we can turn to our prayer books. How do we usually eat? We are hungry and we shovel it in, right? Okay. Page 207. Lama Zopa Rinpoche, I love this story. I maybe told it here before. He was teaching in Italy many years ago. They were eating in the gompa. They had a big gompa. And then they had a translator from English to Italian. And Rinpoche, you know, they know Rinpoche has very long food offerings. Sometimes a half an hour and the food's all cold if it's a hot lunch. So people knew we're expecting this. And Rinpoche said, visualize yourself as big as a house. Right? And the translator interpreted into Italian. Everybody ready for a long food offering. And Rinpoche said, and now eat. And so everybody laughed. And then they were ready for the... So Rinpoche started again. Visualize yourself as big as a house. Interpreter went, and then Rinpoche did it again and said, now eat. Now less people laughing. Everybody looked up, kind of uncomfortable, and then Rinpoche did it again. And the interpreter looked at Rinpoche and, you know, and everybody looked at each other, and then Rinpoche said, well, isn't that what you usually do? That's how we eat, right? So let's offer so that we don't, you know, a little gratitude. So some gratitude also for any beings who died as a result of the food coming to us. Being grown, harvested, beings were killed, may they take a good rebirth to benefit all. Beings that were harmed, may they be healed. The gratitude of that we live in a place with beautiful food, healthy, wonderful food that's easy for us to access. What's it like to eat in Syria? Place in Syria right now. How do you get your food? So maybe we can just visualize for a moment all the beings on the planet suffering right now, hungry, starving, poor. Can we just imagine our food multiplies, fills all the space, and turns into whatever they need to alleviate their suffering? Imagine offering this food to all the holy beings you can envision, and it brings great bliss to their holy minds, food that is completely empty of inherent concrete existence. The food is a product, and it comes into existence based on causes and conditions. It's being grown, planted like that, based on its parts, based on the mind seeing a certain configuration of information, of data, and my mind labeling on that. That's how the food exists. May the food nourish us so we can continue our course in good health and energy, providing us with more tools to understand emptiness, so we can progress along a path to full enlightenment and be of the most benefit to all other beings. It is for the purpose of benefiting all others that we are going to practice the yoga of eating lunch. Om Ahung, Om Ahung, Om Ahung, Lama Sange Lama Chedejin Lama Gedun Te Kung Ije Po Lama Te Lama Namla Chebabu. Please enjoy. And we start at 1:30. So we have about an hour. It will take an hour and a half. So 1:45, is that okay? 1:45. Thank you.